1460 WVOX.
Good morning. Welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for the series on the natural world, education, and culture. Also, chronicler of the demise of Homo sapiens. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, March 24th, 2011, the 5th. Day of spring. Told you it would come. However, winter is lingering a bit. There was, I had to get snow off my car this morning. Cool. But not to worry. Warmth and sun to come in the near future. We have gained 3 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 38 minutes since last we met 2 weeks ago. The sun rose at 6:52 this morning. It will set at 7:11 this evening. We will have 12 hours and 19 minutes of daylight today. The moon will rise at 1:27 tomorrow morning. It will set at 10:48 tomorrow morning. We are 2 days short of last quarter, 5 days after the largest and nearest full moon in a bunch of years. I think it was 25 years. That occurred because the moon's perigee, which is its nearest point to Earth for the entire year, coincided with the full moon. Our next full moon will be April 18th. Next high tides in New Rochelle. At 3:52 this afternoon, Yonkers 2:04, Dobbs Ferry 2:32, Haverstraw 3:14 p.m., and in Peekskill at 3:27 p.m. So if you're going out boating in the snow, it's good that you know those things. Also good you know them just so you know that the tides do rise and fall twice a day. Now our regular feature, the sad part of our program, names of American service members who have lost their lives at war. May they live on in all of our hearts. Staff Sergeant Eric Stanley Trueblood, age 27, of Alameda, California. He was with the 16th Sustainment Brigade. He was killed by a roadside bomb in Kandahar Province on March 10th. These are all Afghanistan. Corporal Ian M. Muller, age 22, of Danville, Vermont. He was with the 2nd Marine Division, also killed by a roadside bomb during combat operations in Helmand Province on March 11th. Private First Class Andrew Martin Harper, age 19, of Maidsville, West Virginia. He was with the 2nd Stryker Cavalry Regiment. He was died or was killed in a non-combat incident in Kandahar on March 11th. By the way, in case you didn't know, and I didn't until I looked it up, the 2nd Stryker goes way, way back to Andrew Jackson's time, and it is a light armor. They've got tanks and other armored vehicles, if I'm not mistaken. Sergeant First Class Day Han Park, age 36, of Lacey, Washington. He was with the 1st Special Forces Group. His vehicle was also struck by a roadside bomb in Wardak Province on March 12th. Private First Class Arturo Emmanuel Rodriguez, age 19, of Bellflower, California. Screaming Eagles, 101st Airborne Division, killed by small arms fire while on dismounted patrol in Paktika Province on March 12th. Corporal Valerie Verschiani from Kutaisi, Georgia. He was with the 3rd Infantry Brigade, died March 14th. He was injured on March 5th in an explosion in Helmand Province. He died at the Landstuhl Medical Center in Germany. Staff Sergeant Travis M. Tompkins, age 31, of Lawton, Oklahoma. He was with the 10th Mountain Division. Died March 16th. He was injured on March 15th in Logar Province by a rocket-propelled grenade. Marine Lance Corporal Christopher S. Mice, age 20, of Bennett, Colorado. He was with the 2nd Marines, killed in combat operations in Helmand Province on March 17th. That would be 1 week ago today. Private First Class Rudy A. Acosta, age 19, of Canyon, this is Canyon Country, California. I think it's a typo. I think it's Canyon County, California. He was also with the 2nd Stryker Cavalry Regiment. He was one of 2 soldiers shot and killed with small arms fire in Kandahar Province on March 19th. The other one killed in that same incident was Corporal Donald R. Mickler, Jr., age 29, of Bucyrus, Ohio. Staff Sergeant Misolas C. McDaniel, age 33, of Fort Hood, Texas. He was with the 1st Infantry Division, killed by a roadside bomb and small arms fire in Coast Province, March 19th. And finally, Staff Sergeant James M. Malachowski, age 25, of Westminster, Maryland, also with the 2nd Marine Division, killed by a roadside bomb during combat operations in Helmand Province on March 2nd. There have been just 3 American combat deaths in Iraq this year, all in January. So Iraq has certainly wound down. There are still occasional incidents, but Iraq is more or less stable. These 12 American servicemen were alive on the date of our last broadcast 2 weeks ago. Thousands of American servicemen and women and our allies are at risk of their lives at this very moment, and many will be killed. Many will be broken in body and spirit. This is true. I see former GIs at the VA hospital all the time. Some function well, but those who have seen combat are never the same. Everybody comes back different. A buddy of mine fought in World War II 65 years ago. He still dreams of Japanese soldiers firing at him in the jungles of the Pacific where he fought. When he wakes up, he's just happy that no one is shooting at him and that he no longer has to shoot at people. 65 years later. So everybody comes home with baggage. If you've seen combat, veterans like myself who did not see combat come home with much better memories. But these guys have, it's a different class when you've seen combat. Please keep them all in your hearts, those who have passed and those who are still with us and who hopefully will make it home. Your freedom is in their hands every single day. Each death is a great loss to their families and to all Americans. May they live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the near future because there are no more deaths to report. This is time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions and you have the right to disagree with them because everyone has the right to be wrong. I'm not actually going to review this play, but we did see Robin Lichtig's new off-Broadway production of Play Nice at 59 East 59th Street Theaters. I'm not going to review it here. It's on my website, www.environmentallysound.org. If you're really interested in it, it's, as all of them are, they're interesting essays to read. At least I think so. I enjoy writing them, but I'm not going to take the time here. Okay. My first guest is Bobby McEnany. He's public lands expert with the Natural Resources Defense Council. The NRDC has over 1 million members nationwide and a group of lawyers headed by Bobby Kennedy Jr. The total professional staff, including lawyers, scientists, and others, by their count, is over 350, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Bobby McEnany.
Good morning.
Did I get your name right?
Yeah, okay. quite well, thank you.
Okay, it doesn't look like that, so I wrote it out phonetically, and I think that's the way it was presented to me. Okay, well, what I'd like to talk about in the few minutes that we have this morning is the Bureau of Land Management is opting for a certain option for development of the lands in 6 states in the West. I believe the NRDC, of which you're a part, would like to develop it solar and sustainable, and they have other ideas. Why don't you get started, then we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll finish that.
Sounds good.
Okay. Tell us what you're doing and what the BLM is doing.
Well, we've talked about, as an organization and I think as a nation, that green energy future, renewable energy, solar and wind need to be part of sort of America's energy profile. And for years and years and years, it's been mostly talk. And but just in the last year or two, we've sort of reached the event horizon where solar, especially solar, but wind too, have become basically in a reality. And trying to decide how we're going to actually site solar, site wind, but we're going to talk about solar today, how we do that on federal lands in the West is proving to be quite difficult. There are a lot of sort of issues dealing with the economy of scale, the environmental issues, and how do we actually end up putting these really massive, unprecedented projects on federal lands that we've never done before. There's no sort of scale up. We're not starting small, going from 100-acre projects up graduated in a slow sort of fashion. Instead, what the administration has decided, what the industry has decided, and to some extent what a lot of other NGOs like NRDC have decided, is that it's time to go ahead and just sort of put everything down and see what we can do with these really large, massive, you know, 5,000-acre projects.
Now, it seems to me that the far west, the New Mexico, Arizona, has desert, which would be ideal for gathering solar. Am I correct?
It is the world, as it, you've probably heard this metaphor quite a bit, but our analogy, it's the Saudi Arabia of solar. The lands in California, Arizona, New Mexico, are the lands that we're talking about are at high altitude. They have tremendous solar potential. The weather is almost constantly sunny, so and you don't have the issue of intermittency. So,
and there's not a whole lot of vehicular traffic passing through there either, is there?
No, there's not. Not a lot of roads. A lot of them are dry desert washes. So
what's the problem? I would think it'd be perfect to put those things up in there.
Well, I think when you throw a dart in the West, you're going to end up with hitting some sort of interest. You know, I grew up in the West, and there's a lot of sort of ecological issues. There's a lot of sort of socioeconomic issues, and trying to find those best places that don't necessarily violate natural species, some of the places that are really sensitive, trying to find the places that have the best potential all at the same time and trying to reduce as many conflicts as you can is still really tricky.
Okay, Bobby McEnany, we're going to take our break. You are, in fact, from the Rocky Mountain region, if I read it correctly. And we'll be back with you in a second. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in any place that's not in our listening area, you have logged on to www.wvox.com. You're listening live. We will be right back.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, initial jobless claims falling more than expected in the latest week as fewer Americans join the unemployment line. First-time unemployment benefits dropping to 382,000, signs the job market may be gradually improving. The four-week moving average, which smooths out volatility, fell to its lowest since July 2008. Durable goods unexpectedly fell last week, seeing the biggest drop in 4 months. Orders dropped 0.9% in February, largely in part to lower sales of machinery and defense-related products. And AT&T may have a hard time getting approval for its $39 billion deal to buy T-Mobile. An official from the Federal Communications Commission telling the Wall Street Journal it would at least be a steep climb for the deal to go through. Since the deal was announced Sunday, there have been growing concerns about competition and whether fewer carriers could lead to higher prices. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Robert Gray.
Have you ever clicked the like button on a Facebook page to tell people you liked what it stood for? Apparently, a growing number of people of all political persuasions really like the idea of keeping decisions about your health care between you and your doctor and away from Washington insiders. To see our plan for making it happen, visit healthcarecompact.org. That's healthcarecompact.org. Log on today and help turn a Washington failure into an American success.
For more than 50 years, Vox Populi, the voice of the people. Heard in the land right here at AM 1460 and all over the world at WVOX.com.
1460 WVOX.
Okay, we are back. We are talking with Bobby McEnany. He's the he's with the National Resources Defense Council. Actually, he's a public lands expert. Bobby, there was a draft administration proposal considering two alternative approaches to the solar projects in the West. One would ensure that large-scale solar projects are built in an environmentally responsible manner, such as limiting conflicts with wildlife habitats and other sensitive areas. But strangely, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, prefers the other alternative to open 22.5 million acres to development, including a lot of land that should be off limits. More than 1.5 million acres satisfy the definition of wilderness established by the National Wilderness Preservation Act. They would be impacted by this proposal. Now, the Obama administration says that they favor the solar one, but BLM, which is part of Interior Department and under the administration, somehow differs. How can it's like a kid saying no, you go to bed now to his daddy? How does that work?
Well, actually, I mean, I think that's an excellent question. I'm not exactly sure why the BLM is choosing the sort of path that's going to probably produce the most conflict. We're talking about an infant industry that needs all the help it can get. And by going toward a path where you're opening up 22.5 million acres of land that are open for potential development, most of that land, from our perspective, is not necessarily the place where you're going to be successful in building a solar project. A lot of it is, as you said, is on wilderness lands. A lot of it involves endangered species, such as the desert tortoise or sage grouse. And the idea that you're going to go ahead and just be a little more laissez-faire about that approach for an industry that's really sort of just on the cusp of succeeding seems to be a little contrary to actually having a directed path or a developmental path that really leads to success.
So how does the Bureau of Land Management get to even have an opinion? If they are part of the administration, why doesn't Obama say, this is the Bureau of Land Management's position, I decree it?
Well, that's a great question, too. The BLM itself has an interesting sort of institutional history. It's been around in different various forms since the early 19th century. It was one of the governmental agencies dealing with sort of gold rush during the 19th century, then oil and gas later on. And there's sort of an institutional culture there that doesn't necessarily always, I think, that sort of relies on past examples and past histories. And what we've seen this with oil and gas development is that sort of there's a nilly-willy approach, right, in that anyone can sort of stake their claim to a piece of land and then develop it. And the BLM has never really been necessarily really good about thinking about what's the most logical approach economically, environmentally, in citing these types of industries.
Okay, so the question still is, how do they have an opinion of their own? But apparently they just somehow do. Tell me, the National Resources Defense Council often goes to court. Will you be doing that in this case to try to get the proper outcome?
We're still, the actual analysis is still in draft form. The comments are due at the end of April. So until first, we have to sort of resolve how the BLM is actually going to finally decide how to do some of these projects. The issue, I think, is not even if NRDC is going to litigate. The fact is that the best way to do this is to reduce conflicts, to find the places that are near transmission, near roads, near population centers.
What is the NRDC's role in the process?
Well, we've been working for a long time actively with developers, with BLM. What happened was, and I'll just step back, for last year you had the stimulus funding program, and what happened was a lot of money was put on the table, basically saying to developers, if you can get your projects done, you will be you'll have about a third of your upfront costs taken care of. So there's sort of a gold rush mentality that happened in 2010 through 2000, starting in late 2009 through 2010. So we had a number of projects lined up that the BLM chose as potentially receiving these treasury funds. I think the BLM ended up citing about 9 projects. Not all of those projects were appropriate. Some of them were, but we had to basically go in and walk the ground and walk the earth and tell developers, we think these are good areas to develop. These are probably not areas you want to develop, in order to avoid the conflicts that I was talking about before. That's not really a great way to run a large industry, is having stakeholders, as we call ourselves, involved on the ground level, telling people, giving people advice on how to sort of site projects.
Okay, let me just interject something. My impression, and it's only an impression, I could be way off, is that the BLM is more a tool of the cattle industry, the grazing industry, that they have always supported those interests. And incidentally, I did reach out to the BLM to have them have a representative on this program, but they did not respond. So what about that? Are they very, very industry friendly, like the National Nuclear Regulatory Commission is with the nuclear industry?
That's an interesting comparison. I've worked on nuclear waste for a long time as well, unfortunately.
So you know the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
I do. In some ways, the way that BLM was chartered was to support industry. So if they are guilty of sort of favoring industry over sort of other interests, I think it's part and parcel of how they were actually set up.
But by other interests, doesn't that mean real, proper, safe, and economical energy for the American people? I mean, is it industry against the American people yet again?
Well, I think, with BLM, they have no experience with this process. And what they're actually doing, they're using a rule that was based on it's really bizarre. Basically, they're using a regulatory rule to permit these projects based on the rule that they use to approve ditches. So you have a 19th century construct being used for 21st century technology. So the BLM hasn't necessarily, and they don't necessarily have the tools either from Congress to adapt to this sort of new technology. So I think you do have this kind of clash of cultures of a culture that's been mostly predicated on oil and gas and hard rock mining and grazing, trying to permit solar projects.
We have about a minute left.
Sure.
I'm sure that President Obama appointed the Secretary of the Interior, and that person probably appointed the BLM chief. Is there not a chain of command where you put your guys in there to do your will, or are old guys still in there?
There are still, I think, you will be surprised about how many people at the BLM are still sort of, that may not be necessarily on the same, are not necessarily on the same page as Secretary Salazar.
The heads.
I think that's an issue of making sure that everyone is sort of on the same page. And I think dealing with that culture is certainly a challenge for the Secretary. And I think he's done a pretty good job in getting some of these projects cited. I think, but the long run about how we're going to do this in 20, 30, 40 years is what is being determined today. And so I think there does need to be a little bit more of a concerted effort to make sure that everyone is doing this in a way that is logical.
Okay, very interesting. I'm afraid we have to break now, but thank you very much. Bobby McEnany from the National Resources Defense Council. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. You are listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. I had that paper just a second ago, but I don't. So we have another guest coming up. We have the executive director, Paul Gallet, of the Riverkeeper Organization, which we'll talk about Indian Point and nuclear energy in just a moment. Again, WVOX AM 1460. This is Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold. We will be right back.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Ron Flatter. Enforcement of the no-fly zone over Libya brings down one of Muammar Gaddafi's airplanes.
We can confirm now from a U.S. defense official, a French warplane shot down a Libyan plane near the town of Misrata. We had been told yesterday that most of Gaddafi's air defense systems had been disabled and that his warplanes had not flown any missions since the start of the conflict. This is the first time that we're hearing about a Libyan plane being shot down. It was the French who did it.
Fox's Jennifer Griffin at the Pentagon. America is flying a smaller percentage of missions over Libya, but it's still trying to hand off control of the multinational operation.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates, while here in Cairo, said the U.S. will not be in the lead for longer than a week or so.
Fox News Radio's Courtney Keeley. NATO is still haggling over terms that could lead to it taking charge of the Libyan mission. Turkey's reluctance, reportedly the biggest obstacle. This is a Fox News alert.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy. I want to talk cars for just a minute, and specifically Chevrolet cars. First of all, you should know I'm a Chevy guy. Always have been. And as you also may know, for many years, I was touting, recommending for all the world to hear another Chevrolet dealer. But ladies and gentlemen, I've recently discovered, kind of late in life, I guess, an absolute gem of a Chevy dealership right here, close to home, in southern Westchester. And so you might say, I don't have to curry favor anymore with anyone, if you get my drift. Now, I'm not the only one who's discovered New Rochelle Chevrolet. It is, in fact, the fastest growing Chevy dealer in the entire region because they do business the right way, with a straight shooting sales team that will find the right car or truck and give you the best prices right away. It's at 291 Main Street, Route 1, the Post Road, as you come out of New Rochelle heading north toward Larchmont. This extraordinary dealership is run these days by a real statesman of the profession, Frank Endress, the executive manager. Actually, I had heard about this nice man and his reputation for years. This fellow Endress has also put together, you should know, the best world-class service department that does all GM cars and trucks now. So it's a new ball game for Chevrolet around here. I've seen the light, my friends. It's called New Rochelle Chevy. They're the best right now, I can tell you, in all of Westchester, and they have been for some time. I'm just, O'Shaughnessy, I'm just, you might say, waking up to that fact. On the Post Road or NewRochelleChevrolet.com.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Here's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity. It looks like some clouds for today, chance of some rain and snow showers. Temperatures for the day will range into the mid-40s. There'll be a little bit of partial sun for the afternoon, then it turns cold tonight. Overnight low temperatures will range back into the mid-20s. It'll be sunny on Friday. Friday's highs 35 to 40, mostly clear at night in the lower 20s. Saturday, mostly sunny in the lower 40s. Sunday, partial sun, then becoming cloudy with our highs in the upper 30s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
1460 WVOX.
We are back. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, in New York. My next guest is Paul Gallet, Executive Director of the Riverkeeper Organization in Ossining, New York, actually less than 10 miles from Buchanan, where Indian Point is located. Welcome, Paul Gallet.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on.
It's my pleasure to have you. And just quickly before we forget, let's just remind our listeners that after this discussion, Phil Reisman will have Philip from your organization as well. So
sure.
There'll be a lot of Indian Point and nuclear discussion this morning.
Well, we appreciate that.
Good. Okay, now, you are actually, as I mentioned, less than 10 miles from Indian Point by road, so way less by actual distance. You've been campaigning for shutting down the nuclear power plants there for many years, and now we have a governor who has also expressed his view that the plant should be shut. And in light of the recent catastrophe and near nuclear catastrophe in Japan, this would seem to be Riverkeeper's time to make its point as potently as it ever can. What do you say about that, Paul?
Well, people are focused on this issue like they never have been before. It's only human to see what's going on halfway across the world and say, can it happen here? And then to think, well, what if it did?
Well, in fact, I was reading somewhere where it said, yes, it can happen here. And in particular, let's focus on Indian Point, since that's of the most local interest. Indian Point, as most people have just learned, is actually sitting on fault lines which could actually become unstable and cause earthquake. And Indian Point is, I think, rated the worst constructed to withstand such stuff. Am I right about that?
You are. It's a question of not only how big the quake could be, but also how the plant was built. You know, out in California, they've always known that they could have earthquakes of 7.0 magnitude or greater. So that's how they planned it. When they built Indian Point, the information they had available to them said that the worst quake would be a 3.0 on the Richter scale. Columbia University and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and an agency called the U.S. Geological Survey have found information using better equipment and stronger instruments that suggest there's not one but two fault lines crisscrossing about a mile north of that plant, and that there could be a risk of a 7.0 quake. And Indian Point's officials are walking around saying, don't worry, we can handle up to a 6.1. Now, a 7.0 has 30 times more energy than a 6.1, and I don't know what kind of math that they do over there at that plant, but I don't see margin for error. I see risk.
Well, okay. I have a book in front of me called The Revenge of Gaia by James Lovelock. Now, Patrick Moore, to me, has been very discredited. He's a shill of industry. You know, the Indian Entergy always talks about how Dr. Patrick Moore, if he's even a doctor, let me not disparage the man. I don't really know him, but He is co-founder, chair, and chief scientist, if he is such a thing, of Green Spirit Strategies in Vancouver, which is simply a consulting firm which provides paid public relations efforts, lectures, lobbying, et cetera, et cetera. And he's a big proponent of nuclear energy. His word sounds very good when Entergy quotes him. But James Lovelock, whose book, Revenge of Gaia, James Lovelock is a very well-known, highly respected, internationally known scientist who created the Gaia hypothesis, that the Earth is actually a living ecosystem, including all the rocks and all the sand and everything else. It's all part of it, and it all evolves and interacts together. He says that nuclear energy, I'm going to play devil's advocate a bit here. He says that nuclear energy is crucial to transitioning to better fuels because of the toxicity of fossil fuels. So what is the difference really in terms of risk between the two?
Well, you have to look at the fact that nuclear energy can fail more catastrophically than any other source of energy. I'm looking at a report you can find at the website for the operator of the plants in Japan. It's called TEPCO. I guess it's Tokyo Electric Power Company.
Right.
And, you know, their safety measures page, which is still up, says, designed for the largest conceivable earthquake. Safety measures derive from our top priority to ensure that under all conceivable circumstances, the community will be protected from hazardous radioactive substances. All designs provide margins of safety capable of withstanding even natural disasters. You know, history is littered with examples of people who said, it won't
right.
happen here, it can't happen here. We're
right.
just that good a bunch of engineers. If something is too big to fail, no matter how attractive it may sound on paper, when you see how it performs out in the real world
right.
and you know the risk, if it's too big to fail, it's too big to rely on.
And as they say, if you want to make God laugh, make a plan.
Hmm.
Okay, so this fellow McIntyre with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said that the agency believes that a 10-mile evacuation zone, which is actually required, is adequate for what would be an anticipated event, anticipated, just what you were saying. And then he says, by the way, in Japan, you have a multiple worst-case scenario. Well, yes, but you can have multiple worst-case scenarios. You can have the perfect storm. So what is an anticipated event when so many lives are at stake?
Everybody knows that you cannot evacuate in a 50-mile zone around Indian Point. Even Indian Point knows that. You know, the New York Times asked Jim Steets repeatedly, could you evacuate a 50-mile zone? And he refused to answer the question.
Well, he knows
because there's
can't.
Only one answer to that question.
No.
No. So then you get the 10-mile evacuation plan. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of absurdities in that plan, which, by the way, even if it was a great plan, it wouldn't be enough. You had Governor Pataki's hand-picked consultant, a former FEMA chair, James Lee Witt, FEMA's the Federal Emergency Management Agency, say that this is a paper plan for a paper emergency and that it doesn't provide for adequate systems to protect the public from actual radioactive releases. So you have no evacuation plan worth a darn. I'll tell you, if you believe in this plant, you better hope like heck that you're right, because you know in your heart you cannot evacuate this plant.
You can say hell on this station. That's about as far as you can
okay.
go. You can't say.
I'll stick with heck for now. Until, when we talk about the NRC, then I'll go to hell. Maybe I should rephrase that.
Well, okay. The Indian Point plant is, according to this paper I have in my hands, from the New York Times. I think so, May 6, 2009. So it's not the most current. It says that it's one of the nation's worst nuclear power plants. Five months after Indian Point number 2 opened in 1973, it was shut down. I think it's shut down permanently now, is it not?
Unit 1 is shut down.
Unit 1 is shut down.
Shut down for decades.
Okay, now, the total death toll from Chernobyl, which was the worst nuclear disaster the world has ever known, the total death toll is anticipated when all the people who got infected die of cancer and all that to be 10,000, which isn't a huge number. And 10,000 people die, again, devil's advocate here, 10,000 people die of coal dust and fossil fuel-related diseases. I believe the statistic was 10,000 every year in the United States alone. So, and as Lovelock says, that even in Chernobyl and places like that, it does not destroy all life. It kills a lot, but it kind of cleans it up like a forest fire cleans up dead wood. Am I being overly morose or gruesome?
I'd go with ghoulish. I think to say that 10,000 people dying in an accident is acceptable damage is kind of awful.
Okay.
Because we're not talking about 10,000 deaths from radiation or 10,000 more deaths from coal. You know, we have studied what happened in California after they had their rolling blackouts in the year 2000. Within 6 months, they saved between 10 and 14% of their consumption simply through conservation and energy efficiency. So it wasn't a question of 10,000 more deaths from this, that, or the other thing. It's less consumption, avoid waste, preserve our way of life. Just don't leave the AC running when you're not around, and don't leave the AC maybe at 60, 67, 68. You can save enough power.
Well,
do without Indian Point, and then you don't have any deaths.
You remember what happened to Jimmy Carter when he suggested that we wear a sweater rather than turn up the heat. It was a huge outcry that he was trying to change the American way of life. Yeah, that quote is that...
Do you remember when Richard Nixon reduced the speed limit to 55 miles an hour? He was part of the Greatest Generation. They understood what it took to defend our way of life. We're going to have to figure that out again in this country.
Okay, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be back with Paul Gallet of The River Keeper, and we'll talk some more about this. You're listening to AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening anywhere outside of our listening area, I do not have my sheet with me today. You have logged on to www.wvox.com. I am Bob Levinsohn. The program is Environmentally Sound. Again, my guest is Paul Gallet of The River Keeper, and we will be right back.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. Muammar Gaddafi suffers a blow.
We can confirm now from a U.S. defense official, a French warplane shot down a Libyan plane near the town of Misrata.
Fox's Jennifer Griffin, it's a first in the enforcement of the no-fly zone over Libya.
We had been told yesterday that most of Gaddafi's air defense systems had been disabled and that his warplanes had not flown any missions since the start of the conflict 5 days ago. So this is the first time that we're hearing about a Libyan plane being shot down.
Two strong quakes, both 7.0, striking northeastern Burma close to the Thai and Laotian borders. They could be felt as far away as Bangkok, but a tsunami was not generated. And a second day of deliberations, the case of a dethroned Texas beauty queen who claims pageant organizers harassed her about her weight. Pageant officials say weight was not the issue and that the teen was unreliable. Fox News, we report, you decide.
A special message from Whitney Radio. The Broadcasters Foundation of America and Fordham University Press are making available a limited quantity of signed first edition copies of William O'Shaughnessy's brand new book, Vox Populi, The O'Shaughnessy Files. Only just now arriving in bookstores coast to coast for $35. Copies of the new Bill O'Shaughnessy book have arrived at WVOX and WVIP in Westchester. For every $35 donation to the Broadcasters Foundation of America, you'll receive a signed, personally inscribed first edition copy of Vox Populi, The O'Shaughnessy Files. Character profiles and heartwarming vignettes of legendary Westchester and New York figures. Jack Newfield, Bob Grant, Ossie Davis, Wellington Mara, Robert Merrill, John Spicer, Larry King, Ned Garrity, Dr. Rich Pisano, Mario Cuomo, Harry Belafonte, and beloved townies like Bill Scolin and John Branca. A dazzling and entertaining tour of Westchester and New York, past and present. You can now pick up signed copies of the brand new Bill O'Shaughnessy Westchester History Book here at our studios in New Rochelle. It makes a great gift for anyone who loves colorful characters and enjoys politics in New York and Westchester. A limited time offer for just $35 to the Broadcasters Foundation of America. Signed copies are available now at WVOX and WVIP. One Broadcast Forum, New Rochelle. Call 914-636-1460 for directions. 636-1460. 636-1460.
Westchester has some really magnificent homes, and the very nicest ones often reflect the handiwork and genius of Michael and Stephen Scully. The brothers Scully have built a legendary reputation as master painters who specialize in interiors, custom wallpaper hanging, and complete exterior home painting. They specialize in quality residential painting. Both brothers are so good at what they do, their fans and admirers of many years have a difficult time recommending one over the other. But of this you can be sure. Michael and Stephen are now considered the two most gifted painters in the region. Call 914-584-4124. That's 914-584-4124. A good number to know about and save for your next home painting project. The Scully Brothers, the very best. That's 914-584-4124.
You made it through a tough winter.
Congratulations, congratulations, congratulations.
Welcome to spring from WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Okay, we are back. We are speaking with Paul Gallet of the Riverkeeper Organization here in Westchester County. Actually, in Ossining now, I believe that is a move. I believe you were someplace else in the recent past. Is that right, Paul?
We were. We moved to Ossining to be closer to the river and closer to the train station, more transit friendly.
Okay, let me ask you a question that intrigues me. There's something called regulatory capture. And nuclear power is a textbook example of that. It's when an industry gains control of an agency meant to regulate it. In the 32 years since the Three Mile Island incident, interest in nuclear regulation has declined precipitously. Analysts, and these are this according to this article, which is in today's Times, independent analysts have said that it is dangerous for the United States to pack five times more spent fuel into these reactor cooling pools than they were designed to hold. 80% of that spent fuel is cool enough to be stored safely elsewhere. So maybe those are two non sequiturs. What about regulatory capture and the NRC?
Well, I was a regulator for 13 years. I worked for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and I must have sued literally 1,000 different folks who violated the environmental conservation laws. And so I can say this with some authority. If you don't have a degree of skepticism, not hostility, not disbelief, but skepticism, if you treat what the industry has to say as more valid because they're nuclear engineers and you're your nuclear engineers and maybe you get employed by them when you leave, if you don't have a healthy degree of skepticism about what the people who hold your licenses are telling you, then you are not doing your job as a regulator. And I got to tell you, I've never seen anything as outrageous as what I heard yesterday from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Which
Governor
was?
Cuomo sends a delegation to Washington and comes back with a promise that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will make the earthquake issue at Indian Point their top priority nationwide. You know what they told the New York Post yesterday? We're in no rush to investigate, quote, because this is really not a serious concern. Post article goes on. Governor Cuomo contended that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's review would be expeditious, but a spokeswoman for the federal agency said that wasn't the case. Quote, this won't start until 2012, end quote, says the NRC's Elizabeth Hayden. Now, folks, I mean, you expect me to say that this is a problem, Indian Point, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but don't they just make that point for themselves? How can you possibly trust the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to have our back to protect us when they're that deeply in the pocket of Indian Point that they tell the governor one thing and then tell the press the opposite?
And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a federal commission? Is it part of the government?
It is part of the government.
And yet they're owned. Well, okay, the FDA has a long history of being owned by industry as well. All right, I had a thought about that, but let me go to something else. I found that quote, by the way. nuclear power has been remarkably safe from one perspective. The Chernobyl accident in 1986 ultimately will kill about 10,000 people, mostly from cancer. Coal plants, fine particulate air pollution, kills about 10,000 people each year in the United States alone. Now, we accept as a society, and mind you, devil's advocate here, but I want to make these points. Cars on the road kill, we accept that. Diseases that you get in a hospital, we accept that. We accept those risks. What risks don't we accept? I get in a car, you get in a car, most of us get in cars. There are more deaths from those things than anything else, I think, and we accept it. So what risk is acceptable? I know it's horrendous to think about a nuclear accident and what it would do. So answer that question. And then also, since it is so close to New York City, I believe 35 miles, what would the actual toll of a meltdown be here?
Well, that's the point. Chernobyl was out in the woods. You know, my family's from the Ukraine, so it's not like I'm dissing the Ukraine.
Uh-uh.
But you have to understand, we're within 50 miles of 20 million people. The death toll would be higher. The damage to the water supply, the damage to the property, there'd be $1 trillion worth of property damage. This would be the biggest disaster in the history of mankind. You cannot deny that. If you're talking about that many people close by, and you're talking about a significant release of radiation, this is going to be far worse than Chernobyl, far worse than what's happening at Fukushima.
Okay, what are the chances that you will be successful in light of Fukushima in shutting down Indian Point and having their bid for a renewed licensing turned down? And also, can the state take action, or are we at the mercy of the NRC? If the NRC decides to relicense it, what can you and Cuomo and any other citizen in New York State do about it?
We all can take action. We can petition the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to include the earthquake issue and the evacuation issue in the relicensing hearing. You know, they turned the governor down when he was an attorney general for just that request, saying, and again, you know, you can tell that I really have some bad feelings about the way the NRC is handling this, but let me tell you why. Not only did they tell the governor we'll make this our top priority, and then in the next breath say, don't worry, this is safe, we won't even start until 2012. But in 2007, when then Attorney General Cuomo said, you need to study this earthquake risk, there's all sorts of new information, some of which is from government scientists, they said, we're not going to study this earthquake risk in the relicensing hearing because you haven't told us how you could fix the problem, if there really is one, or how much it would cost Entergy to fix that problem. Now listen, everybody's heard the phrase Orwellian, which we use when we suggest that government is not talking to us in a way that makes any sense.
Right.
But to say they won't study a problem because you haven't told us how the problem could be solved, that's a whole nother level. Will we close this plant? Absolutely. People will connect the dots. Biggest risk for core damage due to earthquake, near more people than any other nuclear plant, no evacuation plan, a regulatory commission that doesn't give a damn about our safety. People are going to do the math. The plant's going to close.
Okay. Now, no plant, as you say, operates within such a so close, in what they call wafting distance, of such a huge population as Indian Point does. I presume that means you'll breathe it, not just get it through the water or whatever. If there's a radiation leak, it'll be breathed. But no state has ever called for the shutdown of an operating plant within its borders, and New York now does. The governor does. I don't know how Eliot Spitzer and his replacement, whose name escapes me right now, I don't know how they felt about it. Pataki, of course, was more on the other side. Okay, so reassure me, and also tell our listeners just what they can do. Otherwise, they're going to wake up one day, it's going to be re-licensed, and there'll be nothing that can be done about it. What can our listeners do to join this fight?
The U.S. Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, said on Sunday, we're going to have to look at whether this plant should remain in operation. You have to write the governor and tell him to take the strongest possible position. with the president. You can write the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, too, but I think that they have a special wastebasket for emails about Indian Point, and I think this woman, Elizabeth Hayden, is the one who empties it on an hourly basis. You write the governor, you write the attorney general, Eric Schneiderman, you write your congresspeople, and you say, we are mad as hell. We are not going to take this anymore. We cannot deal with the contempt the NRC is showing us, and we cannot deal with the half-truths about Indian Point safety anymore. And believe me, attention will be paid.
Okay, but the governor's already on point, so I don't know. I mean, you could deluge him with letters. He probably won't change his mind because he's already on the right side of the issue. I think our local congressperson, I can't say for sure because I haven't read what she says, Nita Lowey, I think she's on the right side of this as well. But, okay, so you say letters, and the more outraged the people are, the more they express themselves on this issue, the better chances are that this plant will be closed for good.
The longer that level of outrage goes on, the more chance. Tell the governor, tell the congresspeople, the relicensing hearing needs to come to grips with the lack of an evacuation plan and the earthquake risk. Evacuation plan, earthquake risk, relicensing hearing.
Okay, excellent. And I'd just like to remind everybody that Philip, what is his last name again?
Musigas.
Philip Musigas will also be on this station at high noon with Phil Reisman later on, and this discussion will continue. Thanks so much for being with us, Paul.
My great pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Bobby McEnany and Paul Gallet for speaking with us today. The world is in turmoil, from the revolutionary fervor in the Arab world and wars which accompany that spirit, to natural disasters, Japan, Haiti, New Zealand, Indonesia, to the effects of climate change in many places on this earth. Major changes are in order. I personally do not think we have the will to make those changes, but I'm willing to be proven wrong and hope that I am. I am not encouraged by the state of politics in this country. There is no longer a loyal opposition. This is a tough time to be growing up. I urge all young people to get out and get cracking. Our thought for the week, I close my eyes in order to see. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community station. I think Howard Sturman's here. Don't know. He is Howard Sturman of the Fighting Sturmans. And I am Bob Levinsold, chronicler of the demise of Homo sapiens. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great
battle. Download or subscription fees here.
For you, it's tax.